Monday edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. Here to have a guest I've wanted to have on for a long time, someone who's had ample experience in the league, probably through really some of the greatest epochs in the league, starting in 1985 as a player. Then it was a coach in the league for almost 15 years as well, and one of the most respected Portland Trail Blazers ever, Terry Porter. Terry, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, man. How are you doing this morning? Great to be on your show.
I'm doing really well myself, and so I wanted to have you on just to kind of talk about your observations on the league, obviously. I know you still follow things really closely, and I think the place that we have to start, of course, is what the Warriors and Steph Curry are doing. And I assume you watched that game on Saturday, right? Against Oklahoma City?
I wasn't able to watch the game on Saturday. I had another commitment, so I was not able to watch that game. But you can imagine, I heard about it and seen some of the highlights when I got back.
Yeah, so with my theory on Steph, and I think you saw this on that last play, which I'm sure you've seen a bunch of times, where, you know, he just pulls up with a makeable shot for him that basically, you know, nobody else is going to be making on a regular basis. My theory is that he is mentally one of the toughest, if not the toughest guys to guard in NBA history because, you know, he's just so much different than anybody else. What do you think of that?
Well, man, I think the way the game, the rules, and the way the game has evolved, he's become very difficult to cover because, first of all, his unbelievable ability to make, you know, shots for 28 feet and make it with just a normal jump shot, turns into a normal jump shot where before it was considered a bad shot. But also, you know, the way their team is structured. You know, their team is structured, again, in today's NBA, and everybody calls it, it's really small ball. You know, Draymond Green has done amazing. He's an amazing player, but, you know, imagine he's only 6'7", 6'8". And so during the era where they had great centers, you know, how could you have him on the floor guarding a Kareem or guarding even power forwards, a Karl Malone or a James Worthy or, you know, even Tim Duncan in his heydays? It would be for a much difficult, I think, for this team to try to play in that era, been a little bit more difficult for him. But I think what they've been able to accomplish up to this point has been amazing. Their ability to be able to just, you know, when you play a team sport, anybody who's out there who's played a team sport, chemistry is just so important. And they have been able to just have an unbelievable chemistry and just play for each other, hold each other accountable, have the willingness to have anybody get on each other. You know, I think sometimes when you get into a situation like that, you have to be careful on how you communicate with guys or how you criticize guys. And they don't have that. They leave all their ego at the door and they're able to just have this unbelievable situation when they step on the floor. Now, obviously some of that has been built by Steve Kerr, who's done a great job and he's been around a lot of great teams. You talk about those Chicago teams, but I don't think he'll be the first one to tell. Those Chicago teams didn't have quite the chemistry this current team have. They had a lot more explosive personalities on those rosters than this current Golden State team has. So you take all the things in the equation, talent, the togetherness, cohesiveness, great leadership, and great players, and no egos. It makes for a very exciting brand of basketball, but more important for those guys, you know, a situation where they're very successful every night when they step on the court.
So, yeah, you mentioned accountability, and there are some reports during that Oklahoma City game that Draymond Green had this big blow up in the locker room and that he was upset and yelling at everyone else. And, you know, whether that was about holding other people accountable or not, is that really an important aspect of a winning team to be able to just kind of get over that kind of stuff where you're not going to, all right, he yelled at us, but I'm not going to hold a grudge. I'm just going to go out and play and kind of forget that happened, not stay mad at each other?
Yeah, Nate, in a team setting like that where you brought so many different personalities together, when you get into a crisis situation and whoever that particular leader is by voice more so than by, you know, you have leaders who show by their example. They come to practice every day, they grind, they do everything they're supposed to do. But and sometimes in critical situations like that, in the heat of the battle, you gotta have that vocal leadership. Now, it doesn't always come from the coach, and a lot of times it's better if it doesn't come from the coach because the coach is not on the floor competing with the other guy. He, you know, to take the battle term, he's not in the bunker with you. And so you have someone who's speaking in Draymond Green who's in the bunker with him, in the battle, competing with him, alongside of him. And he's bringing awareness to those guys that they aren't pulling their weight. And he's done it enough. They respect him enough because he's done it himself. And he plays that way that it carries some weight. They listen to it. And more importantly, not only do they listen to it, it doesn't become he's calling me out. He's trying to embarrass me. It's, okay, we're not doing what we're supposed to do. We're not doing our job. Let's refocus. Let's get back into the task, stay on the course, and get what needs to be done, how we've been playing. And in that regard, he seems to be that vocal guy for them. I don't think Steph or Clay or Iguodala are the guys I'm looking from the outside in. When you see them have a situation where they go through a bad stretch, and they haven't had many bad stretches this year, but when they in a particular game or lose a game, he's the vocal guy. He's the one who's come out and say he's been disappointed in their efforts, and they respond.
So back to Steph here. You coached in the league for a long time. You played. I mean, first of all, just from if you're matching up with Steph or you're getting in the ear of the person who's going to have that matchup that day, what are you telling him going into that game? Like, what are the things that he should focus on to be, you know, obviously you're never going to shut a guy like that down, but to, you know, specifically, are you trying to keep him out of the middle? Are you trying to make sure that he, you know, are you trying to make sure nobody goes under a screen? Like, that kind of stuff. Like, what are you really focusing on to say, all right, this is how we can at least make his life as difficult as we can just for the guy who's guarding him?
Yeah, when you come across players that are so great and have an unbelievable skill set, and you can go from someone who's great in the post like Akeem, or, you know, someone who is unbelievable in the post, or someone like Michael who's unbelievable in just being able to score the ball, or Kobe, you have to decide, okay, what's their true skill set, or what's their true advantage? And for Steph, his ability to knock down the three ball is a huge advantage. So you want to try to, I don't say take it away, but you want to make sure that within the rhythm of the game, he doesn't get anything easy. It's not like he's in the gym by himself just shooting jumpers. There's always the contested defender in front of him, and you have to try to limit his easy baskets. Now, that being said, it's a lot easier said than done. And then, you know, his other big thing that they really try to do is they run pick and rolls. So you have to try to determine from a scheming defensively standpoint, who's involved. Do you have a big man that's able to switch on to him? Do you have a big man that can't even get up there like a Dwight Howard that's going to really be back? And then all the onus is going to be on that guard to try to determine how you want to try to defend the pick and roll. Or if you're going to have a big that can switch it. And then you're going to have to figure out defensively, scheme-wise, okay, what are you going to do with the other rest of the particular offensive player, that big that set the screen? And most of the time it's Draymond Green who does that. I would first try to take away all Steph's wide open threes. Now, that's in transition, which is very difficult. Try to make sure he has everything. Every shot he takes is a contested shot. And try to force him to finish at the rim. You know, I think that would be the easiest thing you try to do just initially. The second area where he gets a lot of his points, as I mentioned, is the pick and roll. Now, you can't give anybody that great who's involved with pick and rolls. You can go back to Isaiah, Chris Paul, whoever, who plays a lot, who played pick and roll, you gotta give them, different varieties throughout the game. Some games, if you have the personnel to do it, you switch. If you have the personnel to trap, you trap it and get it out of his hands and don't let him get it back. And so those are just a few of the things that you have to try to do when you come across a player that has his particular skill set, his ability to knock down a three from, you know, 30 feet, and his ability to get involved with the pick and rolls, and Golden State ability to really space the court when they run pick and rolls and decide what you're going to give up and what you want to try to make sure you take away from them.
Yeah, so if you got to give up something against this team, you know, you're familiar with the roster, obviously. I mean, what is that going to be? Is it going to be, you know, Andre Iguodala or Harrison Barnes shooting threes? Is it, you know, are you going to kind of, some of these teams that we've seen have decided that they want to put their small forward on Draymond Green so they could switch, like you said, you know, which of those strategies do you think you like? And then also, you know, a second part of that is which of the teams that they might face kind of have the best personnel to do that?
Well, I think you got to be able to do all of them. I think you got to be able to, first you got to identify which group of five guys are on the court together. Is it the starting group or is it the second unit group? The second unit group gives you a few more options in regards to who leave and who not leave on the perimeter when they run, when they're involved in pick and rolls. They don't have as many great shooters on the court with the second group. They have other guys that can do other things. But they don't have the spacing ability when you talk about Steph and Clay on the court together. And so when you talk about the teams that's in the West that has the capabilities of guarding multiple ways or having the flexibility to guard them multiple ways, you can look at OKC, who's picked up, you know, the kid from Denver, the shooting guard. I just forgot his
name. Yeah, Randy Foy.
Randy Foy, who gives them another, you know, small ball option. You talk about San Antonio, who can play small ball with him. You talk about, you know, maybe I would say the Clippers, who can play some small ball with them. So teams that have the versatility to really go small ball and to make them work at the defensive end, you know, put Clay on people and make Clay try to run Clay, try to run Steph, try to make those guys guard at the other end and try to wear them down some, has a chance with against those guys. And when those three teams that I particularly mentioned also have veterans, they've all been part of good teams, they're all coached well, have well coaching, and that's going to play a key part because there's going to have to be adjustments made, in-game adjustments, post-game adjustments when you talk about a playoff series, and then the players are going to have to, you know, make plays.
Yeah, you played for Pop a little bit towards the end of your career. You talked maybe about potentially downsizing. You know, they have Kawhi Leonard, who they could play at the four and do that. But, you know, my understanding is, and this is back when you played for him, was, you know, a little bit more of a big oriented era, but he kind of doesn't really like to downsize like that, right? Like he usually likes to play with two bigs, doesn't he?
Well, during my time, we had two bigs a lot of times, but not yeah. always. I mean, my last couple of years when we had played the Lakers in the Western Conference Finals, we had kind of a stretch four. We had Danny Ferry play some four. And so, but we also had, you know, we had Timmy and David together, part of my stretch there too as well. So, but we did have the 3-point shooters around them because that allowed those two guys to operate in the post. I think Pop has really done whatever's necessary in regards to based on his roster and based on what his opponents are. I think what he's tried to do is have a very flexible roster and a versatile roster that allows him to play just about any style. I think there were stretches there where he shot a lot of three balls and now he's not shooting as many threes as probably when we were there. But that being said, he still have guys that have really, has the capability of stretching the floor and making that space open for Tony and his ability to turn the corner and get in the gaps and then have those shooters on the perimeter to put stress on the defense and how they want to try to scheme against those guys.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about your coaching gig in Minnesota in 2013-14. That was kind of a weird season in a lot of ways. You guys had a great point differential, but you know weren't able to kind of put it together at times and ended up missing the playoffs. But Kevin Love had an unbelievable season under your coaching staff there. What were some of the ways that you guys, when he was the primary option, that you tried to kind of use his unique talents offensively?
Well, Kevin's, you know, again, when you talk about the new generation of basketball, he's a stretch four. And so, you know, most teams, most of the time when we had him, he had another big on him. And his ability, most bigs don't want to go out and defend that 3-point line. And so we tried to use a lot of down screens, big on big screening, where the five man wouldn't be able to switch, on the four, on Kevin, who was a four man. And so Kevin would have a situation where he would be come out to the 3-point line or the elbow or the mid post area and catch the ball with a five on him, where he has the luxury because he's a very good mid range shooter. And obviously he got to the point where he's a very, efficient 3-point shooter as well. Well, now he has a great matchup advantage. His ability just to straight catch and shoot, his ability to drive around the five man most of the time, and his ability to step out the 3-point land, really knowing not a five man is going to go out there. So, you know, Rick did a great job of always trying to put him in a situation where he had options. But the biggest challenge for him now, when you talk about playing for Cleveland, when he was with Minnesota, he was the first option. So when you're the first option, night in and night out, you're going to have a pretty good sense on where your shots are going to come from, a lot of the sets are really, it's going to be played through you, and you're going to get touches, you're going to get touches in your areas where the places, you know, in your spots on the floor. And when you're the third option, you could say he's probably the third option in Cleveland. You know, that from night to night changes. There's not going to be many sets where you're going to get a chance to touch the ball to start it, or the first option in that particular set is you. You're going to be the third option. And most offensive sets at the NBA level never gets to the third option. So it becomes very difficult for him to try to get any rhythm at times of a game. And then more importantly, you know, you go through stretches where you may go four or five times down, not even touching the ball. And so the next time you touch it, you know, your mindset is you better get a shot off, or you want to try to get an attempt so you can try to stay in the flow of the game. So I think that, you know, in Cleveland, they changed their flow of offense a little bit. They didn't use some of the sets that we used. And we tried to get him involved. We tried to get him touches in the post as well. Now, we're not saying he's an old throwback type of power forward where you throw him the ball 15 times with his back to the basket. But he can get 5 to 7 touches down there and still be very effective in between his outside game and his inside game. And they didn't do a lot of that with Coach Block there. So I don't know if that was something they obviously came upon on their own. I don't know. I wasn't in that camp. I don't know exactly how they feel against each matchup. They thought if Kevin was a good matchup. But when you're the third option, sometimes you don't think about what the third option. He has to go find it other ways by hustling offensive rebounds, which he's a very effective offensive rebounder, or get out and run the court.
You know, you, throughout your career, you kind of evolved. You were one of the stars in Portland, and then you moved into more of a role player in Minnesota and San Antonio as your career evolved. But for him, I mean, I feel like it's almost kind of harder to make shots when you're a role player, because it's like, all right, I'm wide open. I'm supposed to shoot this, and I don't know when I'm going to get my next shot. So you kind of put pressure on yourself to make that. Is that true? Is that sort of like something that's more difficult as a role player maybe than people understand?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, when you are a third option or you're a role player, your opportunities within the flow of the game, within the rhythm of the game, night to night, is going to change. A lot depends on how different teams scheme against your star player or your players who really set the table for you. In that case, in Kevin's case, it's LeBron and Kyrie Irving. How defense is going to scheme? Are they going to double those guys? Are they going to let those guys, you know, get their own points? And if they decide to double them, that's where the opportunities may present themselves for him to get opportunities to get wide open shots in a rotation when teams are rotating, trying to cover all the offensive players. Or if they're going to say, okay, we're going to let Kyrie and LeBron get theirs and we aren't going to leave the supporting cast, and then in that case, it's going to be very difficult for those guys to get any type of shots or have any type of consistency. They may get, you know, 4 or 5 shots maybe, and it becomes very, very tough. Become effective in that way, night in and night out. So it will be interesting to see exactly how they go about trying to use him more going forward, so they can be more efficient in regards to him when he's on the court, so he can be more productive for him. Because they need him to be more productive. There's no doubt.
Yeah, I agree with you.
They need him to be more productive. They need to have that consistent third point score. Now his days of scoring 30 points or high 20s, I think, are really limited on that team. But I think for him to score, you know, 16 to 20 points a night and have, you know, 10 to 13 rebounds are going to be important for their success going down the road.
Yeah, I mean, have you seen them running some of that same stuff that you guys ran for him in Minnesota, where he was coming off screens a lot, you know, getting a chance to work like a mismatch, like you said? Or does that really seem like, you know, because he's the third option, they're not really doing that at all?
Yeah, the games I've watched him play, they haven't done many of the things that we tried to do in Minnesota. You know, it's been more pick and roll, giving the ball to LeBron and let him set the table, and Kevin is spot up in the corner. You know, I think that he does have the capabilities to be involved in more pick and rolls. I think that's something that they have tried to use at times with him. But overall, his ability to be in that elbow area and have a matchup where it's a 5-man on him, or get a big-on-big screen where it'd be difficult for that 4-man to get out, allows him that space and that timing to get a shot off. I don't see them running a lot of that for him in the flow of their offense consistently, to have some sustainability for him to know that, hey, I'm going to get 4 or 5 shots in this set every night, and these are the areas it's going to come from. I think, you know, every offense and every team, that takes on a whole new meaning. And obviously with LeBron and Kyrie, who are their best players in regards to what they want to try to get accomplished, that changes everything that he did in Minnesota.
You also had Love, obviously, as a defensive player. Your front court back then was Love and Nikola Pekovic. Neither of those guys are kind of traditional, you know, jumping jack shot blockers, guys that you think of as being real athletic. But nevertheless, your defense, you know, wasn't amazing, but it was pretty average, I think, especially that last year. You're like right around the middle of the league in points per possession. Is Love a better defender than people kind of just think he is, just because he seems like a slow white guy?
I think he's a good, what we like to say, a good position type of defense. Like you said, he's not going to jump and block shots. He's not going to come from the weak side and protect the rim. He's not a rim protector. You know, everybody talks about a Jordan who's an unbelievable rim protector, or, you know, whoever you want to try to identify as a great rim protector. A Marc Gasol, those guys are great rim protectors. Kevin Love has never been a great rim protector. What he's been is a good position defender, and that's what he is. I mean, he can be on the weak side, step in and try to make guys change their shots, but he's not going to leave the ground and make an unbelievable play, because that's just not the way he's made up. He has other strengths that we tried to stay consistent with and try to get him where he can come over earlier and help. And him and Peck the same way. Neither one of them, were in, if you guys try to define rim protectors, they were more charge takers and, position guys. And so when you look at the makeup of the Cavs, I think that's why they went and got, the big fella from Denver, to give him a better rim protector and allow Kevin to, you know, be in position to rebound and do some other things defensively.
Another guy I really wanted to talk to you about was Ricky Rubio, who you had in Minnesota. I mean, he's kind of, you know, a player that's a little polarizing. You know, he's got a great passing vision, but he also, like, you know, can't really shoot very well. And yet, so, you know, despite that, teams really seem to do well when he's on the floor. You know, how is it that he helps teams win despite the fact that, you know, he's not a great shooter and teams help off of him a lot?
Well, I don't like to compare guys, but I would say he's Jason Kidd-like, where I think a lot of people were like, Jason Kidd didn't really be able to, he's not really identified as a great perimeter shooter as well either. But what he did was he did so many other things that really made the team win. His ability to rebound, his ability to pass the ball. And at the NBA level, when you have a point guard that you know is a pass-first point guard, everybody seems to run harder, cut harder, because they know he will make that pass. So that's why I think he just plays wing basketball. Anybody who's ever played with him loved playing with him. Kevin loved playing with him, because whenever you came open, he was going to pass you the ball in a position where you can be effective. And so, you know, his defense on the ball is pretty good. He's not afraid to stick his nose and get a tough rebound. So for me, he just does so many other things that impact the game in a winning way that I don't look at just his ability not to consistently knock down a shot. He's a winner, in my eyes, because he does so many other things that affects the game, and guys love playing with him. And that's huge for a point guard standpoint, playing that position. When you have guys around who love being on the court with you because they know you're going to get them the ball, and you're there to really make them successful and help them be successful. That's a great feeling to play when you're on the court.
Yeah, can we, since you coached him, can you just tell people that he's a good defensive player, that these people who don't think he's any good because, you know, he's a European guy and he's kind of skinny, that those people are wrong? I mean, I think he's really good. Can you just tell people that he's good and we can get past this now?
Yeah, I think any true basketball fan who studies and watches him enough, he does a good job on the ball. He does a good job. He competes. You know, you talk about sometimes the stigma on a European guy is they're soft and they don't defend. He gets after it defensively. He's not afraid to get after guys. He will compete. And so I think he does a good job of playing that position. When you talk about that point guard position defensively, he's good in the pick and roll situation. He's good in one-on-one situations, and he's got great hands. You know, he's very active with his hands.
Yeah, his hands are unbelievable.
Great anticipation defensively. He does a lot of quality things at the defensive end, and he's got good size. So when you talk about someone who has the size he has, the quickness he has, and he gets after it defensively. He's not one of those Euro guys that doesn't want to get after it.
So, I mean, the one thing that he really has struggled with is shooting. I mean, he's 24, 25 now. Do you think he's always just going to kind of be this way, or is there a hope that he can really improve in that area still?
Well, I think there's definitely room for improvement. But what are you saying? Is he going to be a Steph Curry? No, he's not going to ever be a Steph Curry. Just like Jason Kidd and just like other guys who never was great shooters to come in here, you don't have to be a great shooter if you do enough for the other things to help your team win. And you got many guys who had great careers who haven't been great shooters, but they impact the game in so many other ways, offensively by passing the ball, and by defensively and helping their team be successful. So I think that, you know, as his career continues to go on, he's going to get to the point where he can consistently, you know, make a 15, 18 footer and try to keep teams honest. But that being said, still, I think if he's in a situation in a late of a game or in a crucial situation, he's still going to look to pass first to one of his teammates as opposed to him taking a shot, and trying to do that. He's just a throwback type of point guard where he always looks to pass first and he doesn't look to score. And I'm thinking that his scoring, his ability to knock down shots is that important in the overall scheme of things to win games for their team.
Yeah, so you, as an assistant coach, obviously, you spend a ton of time working with guys on their shooting. You know, you also, when you were a player, really improve your shooting. This is one of the things that's really been fascinating me for a long time, is trying to tell, you know, some guys are not great shooters when they're young, but they end up becoming great shooters. Other guys kind of never do. And you're a coach looking at a young guy to see whether he can improve his shooting. What are some of the things that you look at to try and figure out, like, all right, you know, this guy 3 years from now will be able to shoot. And then another guy, all right, his shot's broken. It's probably not going to work out for him as well.
Well, I think anybody can get better. I mean, that's the big question. I think anybody, if you start off with great fundamentals, you can get better. And that comes back from just having reps and getting after it every day. But the challenging part is, you know, you may not be a great shooter, but I'll be the first one to tell you, I did not, and again, I came in the league at a different time. At the collegiate level, when I played, we didn't have a 3-point line, so there was no pressure or no emphasis on, you know, you gotta shoot it from 21 feet. Our college coach, Dick Bennett, the great coach Dick Bennett, we were not allowed to really shoot outside 20 feet, cause, you know, why shoot outside 20 feet when you shoot 18 feet and still count for two? The 3-point line has changed that dramatically. And so there's been a lot more emphasis on, you know, young kids growing up now. And now they look into the league because young kids idolize these guys who play in the league. And you look at the game today, everybody's shooting three. So the ability to knock down a 3-point shot and have a 3-point jump shot has come huge into the growth into today's game at the grassroots area level. And so you gotta have a great foundation and you gotta have a lot of reps. And then as you progress, if you're blessed to progress from high school to college and college to pros, that's where if you have a great foundation with your shot, you're going to get better if you continue to put the reps in and continue to put the shots up. And I was the first one. I did not shoot the ball particularly well coming in the league and definitely didn't shoot a lot of threes, didn't have the range for that. But as the years went on, I realized how important that was to our game, and I had to get more shots up, and I got better at it. And I became a very, a big-time threat out there. And so anybody can get better if you have the fundamentals and you put in the reps.
So do you remember that time? Because I'm looking at your career stats. You basically, your first 3 years in the league, you were taking less than 1 3 a game, and then 88, 89, you're taking 2.7, and basically you're over 3 a game for the rest of the time, and even, you know, becoming one of the best 3-point shooters in the league for a time there in the early 90s. What was that like? Because really, you know, when you first started, teams weren't taking advantage of that at all, and then within 3 or 4 years, that became a shot that a lot of guys were taking. Do you remember coaches saying, hey, we got to start taking this? Did you take it upon yourself to say, hey, wait, 3's better than 2, I should probably be taking more of these? Like, what was that evolution like?
Well, you know, we were still on the verge of, you know, analytics hadn't gotten to the game yet. I think now so much of this is about the analytics of the game. We still talked about the 3-point shot being something that happened after the ball was kicked into the post and it was double teamed and it was swung around to that guy in that far corner for a wide open shot or in transition. You shot a 3, but the way they shoot threes and at the rate they shoot threes today, you just would have never done back then. Coach would have set you down. I mean, these guys are averaging 10, 11, 12 threes a game. And if you go back to that 80 generation, you got guys who are shooting myself, but other guys like Mark Price or whoever you want to pick out, who the guys was in the top 3-point percentage, they were still only averaging under 4 shots a game. Now throw that out there and give each of those guys now 10 or 11 shots, their numbers would be totally different too. And so it just a lot just had to do with just the revelation of the game, the way it is today where, you know, you don't have any big man in the game. And when I came in the league, coaches, you couldn't take a jump shot unless the ball touched the post. The ball had to touch the post first for the most part. And then if it was kicked out because of double team or something like that, then you could have an opportunity to shoot a three ball. Now, I mean, three ball teams in transition now because of analytics, they don't run for layups. They run for the three point line. If you're a great 3-point shooter, you're in transition. You don't even run for the layup line. You run for the 3-point line in the corner or out in at the wing area.
Yeah. So when you first came into the league, do you think could guys just hit that shot, but they weren't encouraged to take it? Or was that more a skill that people had to kind of evolve to say, all right, we're going to shoot from this far back now, where it really became something that people tried to develop?
That was something that definitely was not encouraged. That wasn't the way the game was being played back then.
Yeah.
It was more, get steals, get layups, throw the ball in the post, try to get the defense to react with the ball being in the post and see if they would double team your big guy. If you had a big guy who was an offensive threat, and most teams had at least one big guy that could post up and cause a defense to react to him being in the post. That was nothing emphasized like it is today. I mean, today offenses are set up to shoot threes more than anything. I mean, these guys are, like I said, they're just the numbers that they're taking, the shot attempts out there is unbelievable.
The other thing that I really noticed a lot I was 5 years old, back in 1985, but just in even going back and watching the games and, when I was starting to become a basketball fan even, I noticed that, from maybe like 85 to 95, I thought at least that defenses got a lot more intense and maybe even a lot more complex as well. Is that something that you noticed over the course of your career that coaches began to emphasize defense a little bit more and having a little bit more pressure defensively from when you started your career in 1985 through kind of that 10-year period?
Well, again, I think the rules have changed that a little bit. Then you could be more physical. You can't do that nowadays. I mean, just think about some of those old clippings you see of the playoff between the Celtics and the Lakers, guys going for layups and they getting, hung, getting knocked down. Even the series when you talk about the Knicks or the Pistons, the physicality of those series, the no layup rule. The new rule where every time something like that happens, you go and you check the film and it may be you run to the scores table and now you talk about a flagrant one or a flagrant two, and during the regular season and postseason, those can turn out to be somebody missing games. So even that has changed the mentality defensively. You can't have that mindset defensively at times to really, get after somebody. You can't touch them when they're on the perimeter for the most part. And now, because of the style of play or how they want to envision it, the offensive player has a pretty much good freedom to roam wherever he wants to roam.
Yeah, I mean, do you think it was better for the game to have, that more physical play back then, or do you think it's better for the game now to have it kind of be a little bit more free-flowing?
I'm not the one to judge. I think that game, I think what it does, it gives the offensive player a huge advantage is what it does. I mean, so you talk about someone like Steph. Now he can just roam free out there. I mean, when I first came in the league, I ran in the paint. I got hit two or three times and Biggs told me, don't come in here, little fella, get out of here. Talk about the enforcers you had back then, the power forwards that you had in the paint. You got a lesson every time you went in and you got hit. And
so did that work?
Just don't have that.
Did that work as a deterrent effect on you when you were a young guy going in? Were you like, all right, I'm not going to go in there anymore? Or did that just make you more determined?
No, I mean, you just have to, your ears are you're recognized when you step in there, you're going to get hit. You just have to be alert. You're more on a alert than you are anything. I don't think it, I wouldn't say it stopped anybody, but nowadays you don't even have to worry about it. It's like if you go in the danger zone, you go in the danger area, you're going to notice you're in the danger area. But if you're in the danger area, what used to be a danger area, and you don't have to worry about getting hit, you're just running. You're just running around free. You're just doing what you want to do. It's freelance. So it's like what your mindset is when you go up against one. Because when you know when you went against the Knicks teams, the Pat Riley teams, you just knew you was going to get hit and hit and hit. Miami teams are going to be physical with you. They're going to be physical with you. As opposed to playing a team back then, let's say you're going to play like a Denver Nuggets team where so much of the motion, you didn't have the physicality as much. But you just knew going into some games that mentally you had to get prepared to get hit every time you turned around. And nowadays, you know, for a perimeter player, an offensive player, you can come off picks, you can put it on the floor, no one can put their hands on you, they can't touch you, they can bump you a little bit, but if they jar you off your path at all, it's a foul. And so it's just amazing how, you know, when you talk about the rules have changed the way the game is being played. Now, defensively, I think, you know, there's obviously a disadvantage for defender players because you can't, the days of the great defenders, Pippen or Elvin Robinson or Michael Jordan, being able to touch you and grab you and get into you, and those days are over. And so the offensive players nowadays, just the ability to just roam free and just have a freeness about you with the ball or without the ball has really changed the way teams guard people and they have to scheme.
So the last thing I wanted to ask you about is you start your end of your career in 2002 with the Spurs. Then you spent a year as an assistant with Rick Adelman in Sacramento on a team that actually I thought was going to win the championship that year, actually, until Chris Webber got injured. But then a year later, you're the head coach in Milwaukee. And what was it like becoming a head coach after only a year as an assistant?
It's a lot of responsibility. It's great that you've been given that opportunity. But you know, I'm based on my own personal experience, I'm a big believer that you learn how to be a head coach when you're a head coach. Because there's a lot of things, obviously as an assistant coach, you can see the head coach do, but there's a lot of things you don't know about. The conversation.
Yeah, like what?
Well, it's just the conversations you have with the GM. You talk about that conversation you have with ownership about the personnel, about playing time. There's a lot of things that you don't know as an assistant coach that you have to deal with as a head coach, along with the makeup or the team, the conversation you have with your leaders on a daily basis. I've never had conversations as an assistant coach with the Sacramento King leaders, Vladdy or Webb. Rick had those conversations. And so when you become a head coach, you got to deal with the locker room, the culture of your team, your leadership, making sure that the leadership in regards to the players, the police, and a lot of things that goes on. You're dealing with the players. You're dealing with the media. You're dealing with the management in regards to the GM and the ownership group. And then, you know, trying to build all that and work all that to the point where it flows well. And that's why you see so many teams now, or you see the teams that are successful, they have a lot of veterans. Veterans that's been a part of winning programs because, again, we talked about it earlier about the Golden State Warriors. Well, they've had success, but now there's leadership among the players. There's accountability among the players. So it doesn't happen always when it comes from a correction or a time to motivate those guys. It doesn't always come from the coach. It comes from within. It comes from the leadership of the players. And those are the guys that will push each other and motivate each other and hold each other accountable. And that's what's so important that, you know, when you become a head coach, you have to get the players on your roster who are committed to doing those type of things. That's going to make some of those things that you have on your plate a little less easier for you to have to deal with on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, so you were a pretty young coach when you first started. And for teams that are kind of thinking, all right, we're going to hire a younger coach, someone who recently played in the league, you know, what's the advantage of that, and what might be some of the disadvantages of that if you're, you know, a GM or an owner kind of looking to make a coaching hire?
Well, the first advantage, and when you talk about head coaching, is always about experience. Now, if you hire someone who doesn't have any head coaching experience, that's the first thing you have. They don't have that head coaching experience in regards to all the things I spoke about. When you talk about a head coach, being able to make in-game changes, adjustments that need to be made, and then the overall culture of the team, does he have the leadership and the vision along with the GM and the owner to try to execute that? That's the one thing. But the positive is, you know, he's most recently have gotten away from the game, so he's still in pulse with what the game is. The player's going to respect what his, what, for the most part, what he's been able to accomplish as a player. He's been, you know, that old cliche, he's walked in their shoes before. He knows what it's like. He knows, you know, over a long 82-game season, when to push him, when to have practice, when not to have practice, based on what their bodies are telling them, based on what he feels. And so there's some pluses in that regards. And if he's been blessed to be in a good situation previously as an assistant coach around a good organization, around a good coach, he has learned a lot about dealing with some of the day-to-day stuff and dealing with some of the things that's important to you know, get that team on the right path.
When you're a coach, if you're with an organization and they have, you know, a younger player, a guy who they clearly think is going to be a part of their future, but maybe a guy who's not as good of a player as someone who's more of a veteran on the roster, but is, you know, someone who's not going to get you as many wins right now as a veteran, but a guy who, you know, maybe is a free agent after the year, he's not going to play anymore. How do you kind of balance those priorities as a coach when, you know, on the one hand, they want you to develop talent. On the other hand, they're evaluating you on your wins and losses to kind of apportion the playing time between those two guys.
Well, I think that's when you talk about leadership, because that's got to have all three heads of that organization. When I say three, I'm talking the ownership, and there's normally one majority ownership who has the vision or the voice, and then there's the GM, and then there's the head coach. All three of those guys, when they look at that roster, they have to have conversations where that has been discussed in regards to having a young guy. And I give you a great example. When I was in Minnesota, after my first 10 years here with Portland, I went to Minnesota and KG was a rookie. Sam Mitchell was a veteran who just left Indiana and been part of a good winning program there, winning team with Larry Brown and some of those good Indiana teams. And I was there when I got there, and then the next year Steph came. And the question that they had, I think, was, do they start KG right away? Put him in the frying pan and let him, you know, let him learn, or do they bring him off the bench? And, obviously based on what they did, they decided to bring him off the bench and let him learn a little bit early on before they put him into, the pressure cooker. And I think, again, it's a case by case basis, but I think Kevin McHale and Flip Saunders had those conversations on how they wanted to try to see his growth, his development, and how quickly they wanted to try to do that. Sometimes you throw a guy in the frying pan too quickly, and it's too much, and it's really a setback, and it's hard for him to overcome that, where if you allow him to gradually get a sense of what's going on, have him sit and watch, but then also throw him in there and throw him out there, he's get a chance to do a better job of increasing his learning curve. So it's a case-by-case basis, but the most important thing I go back to is those three guys, ownership, if he's involved with the process, he's got to have understanding of what he sees. But if he's not involved with the process, then there's got to be great communication between the GM and the head coach. They got to be on board together on how they see the growth of those young guys, and at what point do they think those young guys should start getting more minutes or become starters. Because at some point of that season, if it doesn't pan out that they are in the playoff race or can really, you know, make the playoffs or move to a different position, there's going to be a decision made that, okay, now we're at a point we need to get these guys as much playing time and try to develop them on a much accelerated rate than we did before. And that's when you see some of the young guys after the All-Star break like it is now, some teams that have young, good players that didn't play or start in the first half, now their playoff picture has gotten to the point where it doesn't look like they're going to be able to be involved with it. So they start playing them more to give them more experience and try to help that accelerate that development into the last part of the season and then obviously into the summer league and get them ready for next year.
All right. Well, I think that's a great one to end on. I really appreciate your coming on. This is highly educational, for me and hopefully for my listeners as well. So we really appreciate it.
Nate, I appreciate you having me on, man. Great. Great to be able to talk ball with you and, all the NBA fans out there. I hope you guys are loving the brand of basketball. I'm excited about, the second half of the season and see, especially in the West, see how things kind of pan out, but also in the East. Obviously, there's made some changes being made on the East to kind of see how Toronto's going to finish with Cleveland and, you know, if Atlanta's going to hit their flow and how some of those teams like Chicago, once they get healthy, how they're going to be able to come back and be a factor in the playoffs.
Yeah, well, that assumes Chicago ever gets healthy, right? I grew up in Chicago, so I'm pretty much giving up on that at this point.
Yeah. Well, you guys had a pretty good run when you had a run. So.
No, I'm lucky.
Like you guys don't have a lot of tradition to be still excited about and be proud of.
Yeah, no, I'm really lucky. I grew up in Chicago, and then now I just happen to be living in the Bay Area when the Warriors are doing this too. So I've pretty much, you know, the luck to see like two of the best teams in NBA history basically, you know, in the town that I was in. I'm quite blessed, I guess.
Nate, it's all about you. You're a winner, man. Winner wins. Winning, winner wins. It's simple. I don't know how you do. I don't know how you define it, but winners, they just find a way to win. That's just the way it happens.
All right. Thanks so much for coming on. We'll talk to you all again.
All right. Take care, Nate. Thank you.